friends, and I want you to try to...
Now, Mr. Bloom, we're going to talk about...
Albert.
We're going to talk about the completion of your military service. We now have you with the... During your
R&R... You don't have the time to do that. Oh. I was in the service for 28 years.
I see. Well, I see. All right. Well, let's talk about the wartime service. Yeah. We are now completing your R&R, and your original plans were to come back
and
go to China, but those were changed due to the atom bomb falling. Can you tell us now what you did at that point?
Unlike everybody else in the military services, I did not know anything about the atomic bomb. Everybody else said they knew all about it. I did not. I told you our thinking overseas about the final decisive battles. I came back and I was at home, and as I told you, I met Evelyn back at Shul, and she's making an entrance now. Her timing is perfect. Met her in Shul, and 1 year after that first Yom Kippur, we were married during the power strike in Pittsburgh.
What was Evelyn's maiden name?
Evelyn Dorothy Glick. And we say, a Glick hat mir getroffen. That means
I understand.
Well, good fortune.
Mm-hmm.
But the researcher might not know what that means.
Right.
150 years from now, Glick means luck. So good luck struck.
Befell
struck
you.
Us. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Befell us is good way to say it. And I did have to go back. However, I was still on active duty. I was in Pittsburgh, and I went back to Washington D.C. My old haunts in Washington D.C. And I was going to go to the Psychological Warfare Division of the Army. That was really my first real interest. I was very interested in psychological warfare. As a matter of fact, I can tell you an incident in psychological warfare that occupied us in China. If I may digress for just a minute, sorry for you. We Domai, the Japanese news agency, always used to beat us to the punch. Not always, but very often used to beat us. They were very good in propaganda. We wanted to find a way we could outsmart Domai and the Japanese intelligence agencies. As I told you, it was necessary for us, one of our missions was to keep the Chinese on the side, 800 million supporters, on the side of the Allies. There was no way to do that except support them and help them, but you can't help 800 million people during the war and make them love you. Particularly, China is not monolithic. China is made up of many kind of different groupings. Did you ever see a Chinese like that, young lady? Never saw one like that. She comes from South China. So there are many different kinds of... we have color dark-skinned Chinese, pygmy Chinese. People never suffer. People see mostly Cantonese and Shanghai. At any rate, we wanted to keep those Chinese, all the Chinese, in favor of the Allies. The Yangtze River, China's main river, flows north and south. We got artists together. We had to make cartoons. The Japanese are very scrupulously clean, you know. Baths, you've seen China, Japanese baths. We had artists make funny pictures of ugly kind of animals, turtles and so, they live in mud. And we used to have them put on their head. The heads used to be the head of the emperor, the head of the head of Tojo, or so on. We used to get bamboo. Bamboo, you know, is hollow. We used to have corks. We used to get these funny cartoons poking fun at and derision at the heads of the Japanese government. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with millions of illiterate Chinese whose main lines of communications are rivers and railroads. We used to float down the derision-making cartoons from the mouth of the source of the Yangtze River down through all the river towns through most of China, poking fun and derision at the Japanese enemy. Mm-hmm. The river folk used to pick them up and open them and had a great laugh of about the derisive attitudes towards the Japanese. And this is one time that we outsmarted the Japanese Doma news agency, and that was one of the psychological warfare techniques that we developed exclusively in China. So I wanted it. So psychological warfare was my interest, and it became my mobilization specialty, psychological warfare. I was going to go into the army, and Bruce Buttles, who used to be the assistant city editor of the Post Gazette, was in Washington, D.C., in charge of that unit. I had not known him here, but I knew of him. And we became friends. He wanted me to go into that. And I was going to go into it, but I didn't want to. By that time, I had become an Air Force officer from Field Artillery Air Force, and I wanted to stay in the Air Force, and I did not. So I went to the Information Division of the Air Force in Washington. And that's the long answer to your question.
I see. So then you stayed in Washington, D.C. after you were married?
Well, that was before I was married. Mm-hmm. I was just courting Evelyn then, and I was in the Information Division of the Air Force, and then I was transferred as Public Information Officer of the Air Sea Rescue Service in Florida.
See.
Air Force, Air Sea Rescue Service. And it was from Florida that I courted Evelyn.
I see.
I used to fly up.
Do you remember what year that was?
Well, it was 45, 46.
1946. You were married in 1946.
Yeah.
And then you stayed in the United States for the rest of your military work.
Yeah, I was mustered out from MacDill Air Force Base in Florida.
In 1946.
Yeah.
Now, after you were mustered,
I was married to the Tree of Life, as I told you.
Yeah.
During the power strike.
And how did you manage?
Well, we thought nobody would come, because the streetcars weren't running.
What year was this?
Huh?
The power strike was.
It was October, fall. 1946.
Yes.
We thought nobody would come. I didn't want anybody. I didn't want any crowd. But Evelyn's folks thought that we should have a pretty big wedding, and I was married in uniform.
I see your wedding picture here is lovely.
Yeah.
Evelyn is wearing a suit.
Yeah.
And you're wearing
a fly right out.
Yes. So you were married in Tree of Life in 1946.
Yeah.
And then Rabbi Halpern.
Yeah.
And then you went immediately back to Florida.
Back to Florida. Yeah.
I see. And how long
as a matter
were
of fact,
you in...
we had a big argument with Rabbi Halpern. As you know, on the day that you're married, you're supposed to fast the whole day, according to Jewish tradition.
Before the ceremony.
That's right. You're supposed to fast. It was Yom Kippur. And what we wanted to do, we wanted to fast from the day before, all through Yom Kippur, through the ceremony. He forbade it, and we had big arguments, big argument about it. So he couldn't convince us. So he said, "Will it satisfy you if I consult the most prominent halachist, specialist in Jewish law in the city, namely Rabbi Bernard Pupko?"
Mm-hmm.
I said, "All right, if you want to consult with him." I didn't know him in those days, but I knew his reputation. He's an enormous scholar in halacha. So he consulted with him, and he came back. He says, well, I consulted him. Are you satisfied? And where's that effect? And the compromise was we would fast during Yom Kippur, and we would only break our fast for the Yom Kippur. So we would make a separation between Yom Kippur and the marriage ceremony. And then we would not eat until, you know, after the ceremony.
I'm not clear about what... Tell me.
What?
Explain it to me again.
What we wanted to do...
Yes.
Since it was Yom Kippur, and you fast on Yom Kippur.
Now, your wedding was Yom Kippur...
Night.
Night.
You can't get married on Yom Kippur.
No. The night of Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
The night...
Yeah. So what we wanted to fast is the night before...
Yes.
When you start your Yom Kippur
fast.
Go through the 25 hours...
Yes.
Have our ceremony...
Yes.
And then break our fast.
What did he want you to do?
He wanted us to... To break our fast before the ceremony.
He wanted to make sure that you had Yom Kippur over before you had the wedding.
Yeah, and I said, since you're supposed to fast before your wedding, I'm ready to fast all the way through, and so was Evelyn. So we were going to fast something like 30 hours or something. Like that. Yeah. Anyway, that was a big
good rabbinical.
That was a big argument, as you can see that that would be a very very fascinating argument in Jewish law, and we precipitated it.
So what then did you do?
We came home from the Yom Kippur service. We just broke our fast, just to get rid of, just to signify.
Yeah.
And then we didn't take anything. We didn't have a full meal or anything. Yeah. We just fasted until the ceremony.
And then you went to the shul.
No.
Back to the shul.
No.
The ceremony.
We went to the shul of the ceremony, but by that time it wasn't Yom Kippur anymore.
Yeah.
It was over.
So you had to get married in the evening.
That's right.
Late in the evening.
That's right. Hence the power strike was important.
Yes.
Because nobody.
And it was dark.
Dark. Yeah.
So what happened?
They had candles.
It must have been very beautiful.
Oh, yeah, it was lovely. Yeah.
Then you went
to
Florida.
I didn't like the crowd, but...
You went to Florida. And how long were you in Florida?
Just several months, because I was just being mustered out.
Okay. Now, after you were mustered out...
Excuse me. That I used the wrong term. Officers are not mustered out.
Oh, pardon me.
Officer returned to inactive duty.
All right. Yeah. After you were returned to inactive duty, you went to where? Newly married.
I had been working almost. I had held down two jobs. I was working in the information department of the U.S. Air Force, and at the same time, I was working as a copy editor of the Times Herald.
In Miami.
Washington D.C.
In Washington D.C.
Before I was married, I was holding down two jobs.
Washington.
Working by day in Washington and by night at the Times Herald, because. From incidents I told you earlier, I wanted to make sure that I had a job to go to, and I wanted to have a job of people who would accept me.
Yes, I see.
How was the pay scale in those days in journalism?
Oh, it was great. I was getting $68 a week.
And that was a lot of money?
Oh, I wouldn't say that was a lot of money, but that was a Washington scale.
I see.
So it was good for Washington.
So you had this job in Washington.
It was better than $25 a week.
So after you were mustered out of the service in Florida, you came back to Washington.
Yeah, and resumed the job at the Washington Times Herald on the copy desk.
I see. And how long were you there?
I was there from 46 through 49, about three plus years.
3 years.
3 plus years.
And then you went.
And I want you to know
that
the Washington Times Herald was then run by owned by the famous Sissy Patterson, the famous conservative.
Mm-hmm.
The same family ran the Chicago Tribune, the New York Daily News, very arch conservatives. And people are always asking me, did you get orders how to write so-and-so? And I said, as far as I'm concerned, nobody ever got any orders how to write a story.
Mm.
The only thing I remember about Sissy Patterson's orders was that she had bad sight. And she was finicky about pictures. And we used to be going to bed, means going to press. Maybe I shouldn't use it that way.
That's probably all right.
Yeah, when a newspaper goes to bed, you're putting it to press. Some of the stereotypes would come down with those little jeweler's magnifying glasses. And they used to look at the pictures. There was a little scratch on it. We used to move them on what we call on turtles. could you hold up this page? They would take, that's me time, that's before photo offset was so famous.
Yeah, this was lead, all in lead.
Yeah, zinc etchings.
How was it?
The type was lead, but the pictures were zinc etchings. They used to move that back and reshoot the picture and the zinc etching so the picture should be perfect. And that's the only orders that she ever gave us. And she used to come in late at night with her mink coat over slacks, before it was fashionable for women to wear slacks. She was, she made her own fashionable rules. She used to fling off her mink coat and fling it on the copy desk. Copy desk, is in a semicircle where the headlines are written on a newspaper. And the fellow sits in a cutout area called the rim, the chief copy editor. And she used to fling it across the desk and sit down and shoot the breeze with the boys at midnight, just as informal as could be, even though her fingers sparkled and
she didn't impose her
never. Although I'm sure that the editorials were not a matter, but I just want to show the arch conservative was was yeah. very, and another interesting thing about that is the newspaper was very keen about headlines, you know. It was a 24-hour newspaper, one of the few mm-hmm. in the country. And it was a thing that stood in the way of the Washington Post ever becoming a national newspaper. We were like a bone in publisher Eugene Meyer's throat at the Washington Post, because there was that significant quarter of a million circulation, whatever it was enough to keep the Washington Post from A, making money as it does today, and B, from becoming a national newspaper, which he wanted to become. Anyway, so they went for sharp editing and sharp heads, and they had contests for headlines. You were asking about the salary.
Mm-hmm.
And there were prizes for headlines, two prizes a day, a $15 prize and a $25 prize for the best headline. And for the time we were there, I was virtually paying my rent on writing the sharp headlines to win the prizes.
Yeah.
And I thank my you talk about a cultural interest in the family. I thank my family for giving me such a background in literature that nursery rhymes came in wonderful for headlines, rhyming nursery rhymes, because you had instant communication. Anyway, I was paying my rent.
Yeah,
that's good. Now, after you were at the Washington Times Herald, you left there after 3 years?
Yeah, about that, yeah.
Why?
Well, Joseph Schumann was city editor of the Post-Gazette at that time here. Those were the times when the city editors ran the newspapers in many cities, including Pittsburgh. And Joe Schumann, who was a wonderful friend and a very bright and sensitive
Was
Southerner,
he Jewish?
He was born Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
He married Anna Jane Phillips from the Phillips Company, Phillips Smelters, and they're a very prominent family, and she was a feature writer. And he married Anna Jane, who was a wonderful feature writer, bright as could be. At any rate, I knew Joe casually, having made his friendship when I was at Duquesne. And I probably would have gone to work there earlier if it had not been for the war. Anyway, Joe and I kind of kept in touch off and on. And the Post-Gazette was starting a Sunday newspaper, if you remember. And Joe came down to Washington to interview me and asked me to come back and offered me what was then, to me, a very fine salary. Mm-hmm. Far beyond anything that I could expect. At the same time, you know, I had some anxieties about leaving, as I told you, the news capital of the world. So talked over with Evelyn, and since our families were here, it was a great pull to us. And so we decided to come back in the Post-Gazette and started the Sunday newspaper. If you remember, the Sun-Telegraph at that time said that there was a deal between Paul Block, who was Hearst's national circulation manager at one time, and evidently had gotten sufficient funds from William Randolph Hearst to buy the Pittsburgh Post and the Gazette Times in 1927 mm-hmm. and merged them. And he said, and the Sun-Telegraph said, at that time there was an agreement that the Post-Gazette would not publish the Seventh Day. Not the Seventh Day. There's only one Seventh Day. That's Saturday. The first day, which is Sunday.
Right.
Sunday's
mm-hmm.
the first day of the week. Post-Gazette
would not publish Sunday. 7 days a week.
Would not
in
publish
it. Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a big lawsuit, if you remember. They brought a lawsuit back and forth. And the Post-Gazette's war chest ran out. To my mind, they started at the wrong time of the year because advertising budgets are made at a special time of year, and they should have had it 6 months before Christmas. But that's another story. At any rate, the Post-Gazette started the Sunday paper. I came back as assistant Sunday editor.
Assistant Sunday editor. Mm-hmm.
And Joe was the Sunday editor. He was going to give up his city editor job, become a Sunday editor. And I was in charge of the black and white sections, the think sections, mm-hmm. that we called them at that time.
Mm-hmm. And what are the dates that that this happened on?
Well, I guess 1949-50, I guess you would say.
How long did the Post-Gazette have a Sunday paper?
I don't know, I think it was a year or two, something like that. And then that suit just knocked it out. But eventually the Santelli, if you remember, was on weak legs, and the Post-Gazette took over the Santelli.
Mm-hmm.
And from then, and from that time, a short time, a few years later, the Post-Gazette and the Pittsburgh Press made their present deal, if you remember, that was approved by the antitrust division of the of the U.S. government, which was one of the few, well, it was one of the first combination of newspapers in the same city to protect a second voice in the city. Remember, newspapers were starting to go by the board. Newspaper publishing is a very expensive business.
Mm-hmm.
Also, printing was being revolutionized. You know, we were going from hot type and lead at Utah to cold type from computerization.
Mm-hmm. So you were the assistant. You worked on the Sunday paper of the Post Gazette for about a year.
About 2 years.
And then what happened?
And then I went when the Sunday paper went by the board, the Post Gazette went back to its 5-day operation, and I went to the copy desk and the repertorial staff, and from that I became the special writer in foreign affairs and the science editor. I did a lot of medical writing, if you remember that.
Now, did you have any difficulty becoming a science writer?
No. Science ran in the family.
Yes.
There were two physicians in the family, two pharmacists. I was interested in science.
And Paul Block was still the editor. I mean, the publisher.
No, he had died.
Oh, he had died then?
Bill Block, the father of Paul Block had died. There is a Paul Block Jr. who was in Toledo, and probably still is. And Bill Block here is the publisher of the Post-Gazette. If you look at the Post-Gazette masthead today, it says William Block and Paul Block Jr. co-publishers. Okay. They're the two brothers.
And how long were you at the Post-Gazette in all?
49-50.
Mm-hmm.
To 1962, when I was the founding editor, I became the founding editor of the Chronicle.
Yes. Now, we do want to talk about this business of being the founding editor of the Chronicle and how that came about. Because at that time, there were other Jewish papers in the city, if I'm not correct.
That's true.
Shall we address that right now?
All right, if you wish.
Go ahead. You're on.
Well, as you know, there were at that time the Jewish Criterion and the American Jewish Outlook. And the Federation of the Community, one should say, didn't feel that it was getting its story across because the circulation of the two papers was relatively very small. Therefore, the aim was to have the community purchase the two papers, fold them, which means put them out of business in newspaper lingo, and start a new one in its place. That was to be the Jewish Chronicle. So the Federation, which was the father of the Chronicle in effect, purchased the two papers, one from the Alter family, the Jewish Criterion, and one from the Gollum family, the Outlook, and folded them and started the American Jewish Chronicle. The Jewish Chronicle of Pittsburgh, and the purchase of those two papers obviated what people feared might be a fight within the community going public on organizational life driving private business to the wall. The people in the community, Federation leaders, did not want that kind of a raw battle to erupt in the community, so they negotiated because there were communal relationships and family relationships and stuff. So nobody wanted, at least nobody that accountant wanted that kind of thing to erupt. There was some opposition, but it was never seriously expressed. There were threats and so on and so forth by some, but didn't amount to anything serious, although there was a kind of fear that this should disrupt the unity of the community and the acceptance of the new publication. At any rate, these were purchased through Federal Get Ration negotiations, and then after having been negotiated, the Chronicle was then given the dubious duty of having to pay for those purchases. And those purchases were at a figure beyond what those publications would likely have gotten if they were sold on the open market. So the Chronicle had to bear the burden from its resources, starting from ground zero, to pay those the families off, which in due course they did. And there was a franchise fee that the Federation put upon the Chronicle for the right to publish. That was the legal technique to make that suitable and proper. And that was at a very significant figure. And I think that was frozen in due course. And the Chronicle to this day pays against that franchise fee, which had developed since the Federation owns the franchise right to publish those publications. And we kept any newspaper, when it acquires other newspapers, keeps those names in small type in their masthead, indicating a kind of a socio-legal right to publish those papers. Now, you can start a paper tomorrow calling the Cohen Gazette, if you wish, and you can publish, but you can't publish under the name of those two either of the two publications which were purchased under the freedom of the press. You can publish under any other name, but not under those names. And the basis of that franchise is, theoretically, you bought the goodwill and whatever other appurtenances there might be for those publications. The fact there weren't any to speak about. Mm-hmm. And the Federation's contribution would be that the Chronicle was given access to its name and mailing list, and therefore it was performing different kinds of advisory services, you might say, plus name circulation, plus whatever. In other words, those are, as I understand it, proper legal assets that are reasonable to exact a price or a payment for. In that way, the thing was all set up. Now, if almost every newspaper in this country, which is in the Jewish field, is either privately owned on one side or publicly owned on the other, but each one is organized almost differently. For instance, the Philadelphia Jewish Exponent is a wholly owned subsidiary of the Federation in Philadelphia, and therefore has a different set of fiscal and legal standards to apply to, since the Federation is a non-profit organization and the Philadelphia Exponent makes money from advertising and one is a wholly owned subsidiary. There were legal tangles in the past, which I no need to run into now, but was very serious legal problems in Philadelphia. Pittsburgh was organized differently. Pittsburgh were organized as the Pittsburgh Jewish Publication and Education Foundation. And one arm of that, the only arm so far, is the Jewish Chronicle of Pittsburgh. But it's theoretically possible with that kind of a foundation name. You can go into radio, TV, whatever in years to come if you wish.
All franchised from the UJ, from the United Jewish Federation.
The franchise specifically deals with those two publications.
I see.
But since we have a joint constitution, we have a constitution for the independent board of the Chronicle, or the quasi-independent, you might say. Really not independent completely, because the Chronicle is an affiliate of the Federation, but is not, repeat, not subsidized by it. So that the Chronicle, in effect, not only shouldered that financial burden of paying off the previous owners, but it in effect gives instead of take, as most organizations of the Federation do. They get, we give.
What are your resources?
Brains, energy, Ahavat Israel, love of Israel. Those are our resources. At least those were the resources to begin with. And make sure that the resources are plowed back into the community in one way or another. First thing, to expand the paper, etc. Newspapers depend on circulation for about 15 years.